And welcome to Nerdstalker. I am Adolfo Ferranda at Nerdstalker on Twitter and all the places. We have a very special guest today, Tom Bilyeu. Let me intro Tom here. So Tom Bilyeu used to be 60 pounds overweight, wore pajamas with jester hats in public, and recently his mom admitted that she thought he was going to be a failure, or maybe not so recently. More on that later. Despite all that, he managed to be part of an amazing support team, which of course includes his wife Lisa, and evolve into the co-founder of a ginormous company called Quest Nutrition, and become co-founder and host of Impact Theory. That's a lot of ands. Tom, welcome to Nerdstalker.
Thank you, man. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, right on. So instead of going the usual way, which everyone likes to go through your, you know, when you were an infant and on that whole thing, let's provide immediate value, right? And because I think it's a really important endeavor that you're now on. It's crazy. Impact Theory. Can you talk all about it, please?
Yeah, let's get crazy. So I read a book called The Power of Myth by Joseph Campbell. And it really gave me an entirely new framework with which to see the importance of narrative. And my background is actually filmmaking. So I went to film school. That was going to be my path in life. And I really only got into business because I didn't want other people to be able to control my art. And I didn't want to come to the world with my hand out. I really wanted to understand how to garner the resources that I was going to need to do things my way. Flash forward, you know, say 15 years later, and really am asking myself a fundamentally different question, which is, how do we end what I'll call generational poverty, which has nothing to do with money and has everything to do with mindset. Mm-hmm. And as I was looking at that problem and really trying to think, like, how do we really solve this, I came back to Joseph Campbell and this notion of the power of myth, where he says basically the way that we transmit ideology as a society has always been through narrative. And mythology has been this powerful carrier of these ideas that tell people how to live their lives. But back in the day, people thought that they were real. So, I mean, think of the craziest mythology you can imagine. And there was a time where people actually thought that, you know, the gods were at war, they were punishing humans. And so, hey, you really better live in accordance with these lessons, because if you don't, you could be the one getting punished. Right. And so, as you become a modern society and people no longer believe the mythology, then what happens? So, the idea behind impact theory is to take both social content and traditional narrative content to show people really this completely disruptive ideology in a way that they can assimilate. And there's been a lot of studies that have come out that have talked about that, that the way that humans really assimilate truly disruptive information is through narrative. So I think there's really five ways that we meaningfully pass on narrative and mythology now, and that's books, comic books, movies, TV shows, and video games. And so we want to be using those mediums, because I'm a big believer in don't try to change behavior, try to leverage behavior. So I know people are going to engage with those five mediums. So rather than try to get them to do something else, I would rather just go create empowering content through that. So to really put a super fine point on what Impact Theory's mission is to do, one is to get people out of the matrix by creating a new kind of studio. So I'm asking the question, what would Disney look like if it were founded today? And right. I think it would look very different than it looks today. And the thing that Disney's gotten so right, so they use what's called a total merchandising strategy, which is how they've been able to stay so financially viable for so long. And I highly recommend that people read the biography on Disney by Neil Gabler, I believe his name is. Absolutely incredible. And Disney understood one fundamental thing that none of the other studios seem to really grasp, which is the name Disney needs to stand for something. And people need to understand what types of movies are going to come out of the Disney studio. Because of that, he's able to make the brand name itself relevant. He's able to get attention for all the movies simply because they're a Disney property. And then you're able to leverage those properties by working backwards to what is merchandisable to create things that are both intellectually relevant as well as having a merchandisable, what I'll call ideological echo. So the reason people buy merchandising from something is to show an affinity for that thing, right? To tell the world and to quite frankly signal back to yourself what kind of person you are. So whether you dress up like Darth Vader or you dress up like Luke Skywalker, you say something very, very different, right? So, And it's, you know, it's a very big concept. So I'll end it there and we can get more into whatever piques your curiosity, but
God, there's a lot, there's a lot, man. So one of the things that I've heard you mention over and over, and I think you touched on it quite a bit, there was this notion of pop mythology. Can you expand on that? Like, what does that mean?
Yeah. So I think that because we are meaning creating machines, like human beings find meaning in anything. I mean, show somebody a cloud formation and they'll see a duck, a person, a mountain range. They're clouds. There's nothing actually there, but we assign meaning to things. And so if we'll assign meaning to something as abstract as clouds, you know, people saying that this is a sign, that's a sign, you can imagine when you give them a narrative that actually has meaning to it, the way that people really like blow that up, it can really be internalized by them, becomes a part of them, becomes something they identify with, something they shape their own identity around. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, that movie was The Matrix. That movie completely changed my life. It gave me a totally new way to view the world, to realize that the limitations that up until seeing that movie, I thought were externally placed on me, I realized were internally created. Mm-hmm. And that if they were internally created, that I could begin to change them and do things that were more empowering. So hiding in pop culture, hiding in pop mythology, are these amazingly powerful ideas, but people dismiss them as being just entertainment. And so what I want people to understand is literally for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, this was how we transmitted cultural ideas, ideas on how to improve, ideas on how to hunt better, farm better, think better, treat your spouse better, like just ways to think about the world and our position in it. And we're no longer listening. So we're creating all this amazing mythology, but we don't know how to extract the value. And I think that the timing is right for us, quite frankly, to come along and show people using social content how to interpret the traditional narrative.
God, there's so many touch points here. One of which is the power of storytelling and how it, God, the results of storytelling in business itself and how it's worked for you. And as well as like down to a level, like where I grew up, there wasn't a lot of dads around, right? And there were a lot of males getting in really bad trouble and oftentimes ending up in incarcerated type of situations. And as of yet, I've heard all these different sort of, you know, people talk about the importance of the male role model and the male story, right? For these young males, you talk about mythology and all these stories that were important for them to sort of shape themselves into men, right? In a type of way. So we used to be able to, as a tribe, you know, do all the type of things. So we're starting to see this sort of comeback to males grouping together, going things like hunting or doing all these traditional type of things that hadn't happened, that there's been this huge gap, which story and mythology often filled. Can you touch upon like the power of story in business, the power of story in society?
Yeah, for sure. So it really comes down to the story is trying to transmit an idea, and that idea hopefully is leverageable in some other way. So I'll just run with your example about males, our role in society, what that all looks like. If you look at what's happened to ritual, and again, this is going back to Joseph Campbell, and he's the guy that wrote The Hero with a Thousand Faces. He worked with George Lucas on Star Wars, really making sure that Star Wars was sitting on a bed of real, powerful, universal mythology. And that's the key concept here, is that the whole idea behind the Hero with a Thousand Faces is Joseph Campbell looked at across time, across geographic regions, back when the world was completely separated and these cultures never touched, they still nonetheless in different wrappings, but they were telling the same story. The hero's journey, as it's called, right? So the reluctant call, at first you don't want to get involved, you get involved, and then you transform as a human being, you come back to the tribe and share what you've learned. That is a universal myth of going from a fixed mindset to a growth mindset to really realizing that you can heed the call, you can go out, you can put yourself at risk, you can learn, you can improve, get better, hit a moment of crisis, fight through the crisis, come out the other side, having vanquished whatever, you know, demon or thing it is that's either internal or external that's threatening you or your family members, the tribe, whatever, and you come back as the hero, but more importantly, you impart that lesson to other people. And when you believe that these stories were real and that it was actually an ancestor in your tribe that did this, you end up creating these rituals around that to help people not have to go through that journey, but instead get those touch points. So we're living in this time where there's really this arrested adolescence where, you know, you're getting 40-year-olds that are living at home. And it really isn't just about economic situations. It's about there's no longer a transitional moment from childhood to adulthood. So back in the day, literally somewhere between 11 and 13, the boys would be hanging out with the women. That would be their world. And then the men at some point would come and physically remove the male children from their mother. They would take them out into the woods. They would circumcise them with no anesthetic. They would knock their teeth in. They would make them jump off a platform with just like a vine. They would put hooks in their flesh and pull them up off the ground. I mean, like all these like crazy, by today's standards, absolutely crazy rites of passage. But it was all the rituals that were built around, like, this is what, you know, that ancestor that ended up saving the day or whatever. These were the trials that he had to go through. And this is the trial of becoming a man. And you now know you're no longer a child. You're a man. And you went through something physical. It was traumatic. It was very acute. And that's a big thing. It's very acute. It's not like, oh, you go to school for a few years and you have graduation. Like, it is, it's super acute. It's often violent, and it's always emotionally memorable. And so you now have transitioned, and that's really something that we're missing. And in the book, The Power of Myth, which was actually taken from an interview series that Joseph Campbell did, and Bill Moyers, the guy doing the interview, says, like, what would happen to a world without mythology? And Joseph Campbell said, look around, you're living through it. Like, nobody believes in the mythology. There's no rituals, don't have any power anymore. So you get this, like, in between sort of limbo where people don't know, am I a child? Am I an adult? He likened, correlated what's happening with divorce rates to that. It's like the poignancy and power of a wedding ceremony is not what it used to be, right? So now they're, they come together, they fall apart a little too easily in sort of his mind.
So let's talk about the team behind Impact Theory. I'm very interested to see, because you guys are executing incredibly fast. You're putting out amazing quality content. You're getting an array of different guests and topics and tips and all kinds of stuff. How did you get all these people together?
Well, it really comes down to, as a leader, you've got to be able to convey your vision. You've got to get people excited about your vision. You've got to make them feel good about what they're going to be able to contribute to. And that was really it. It was about sharing with people what the mission was. And I always lead with that. You know, what are we trying to do? And for us, it's, we're trying to pull people out of the matrix. And you tell people that, you put it out there, you let them know, like, this is how we're going to do it. And then they see that they can contribute meaningfully to something. And you know, look, it doesn't hurt that we pay well. But at the end of the day, the reason that we keep the people that we keep is because there's something more than money. So I think there's really five things that motivate people. Money is on the list, but it's usually pretty low on the list for most people. And the big things are really significance and purpose. And so because of what we're doing, I think people really see that they're going to have the opportunity to really contribute meaningfully to a movement, to help people. And I think that people get that this is a business. And so they're seeing business being done in a new way, where I make the demand that, yes, we're going to be wildly profitable, but it's going to be done in service of something larger than ourselves. And so I'm not a big believer in philanthropy. I don't think philanthropy is going to change the world. I think that building sustainable businesses that at their core have the mandate of delivering value and making the world a better place, I think that's what's going to change the world. So it's an idea that the team has just gotten very excited about. They want to contribute to. I'm always looking for A players. So part of it is just when you don't take all comers, like getting on the team already is exciting. And then these guys are just the best in the world at what they do. And we let them shine. We let them get out there and not micromanage and let them crush it.
I saw a scene of you guys like after a shoot. I believe you are sitting there and y'all pulled the couches together and you're sitting in a circle and you guys are discussing logistically. What do you guys talk about? Like, how do you plan it? And afterwards, how do you execute? Or are you taking input from everyone? Or, you know?
Yeah, no question. So I think that as a leader, you have to have a vision. You have to know what you're trying to do, and you have to be humble enough to know that you don't have all the answers. And not taking the input from your team is a suicide mission for two reasons. One, it assumes that you're always going to think of the smartest stuff, which just patently is not true. Right. And then second, your team's going to be demoralized because they're not going to feel like they're being listened to. And when you remember that for everyone, every single person you ever meet, they are the hero of their own story, right? So you are a side character. And I think people forget that. Like, I get it for my team, even for my wife, like, I'm a side character. So, you know, and that's just the truth. So you want to really make sure, like, I think a lot about, hey, in this moment, in this movement, in this interaction, are they only excited because they're going to be able to tell somebody that they work for me? Or are they going to be excited because, hey, yeah, well, yeah, sure, he's a nice enough guy and I really believe in what he's doing. But, like, I'm here swinging for the fences, me, myself. Right. Like, I get how my contributions help the team and really, you know, are moving the not only the company but the movement forward. So it's like they themselves, how are they going to feel at a party when somebody says, what do you do, right? And if you've created a space where they can say, hey, look, this is what I do. This is how I contribute. I feel very a great sense of purpose. I feel very valued by my other team members. And I feel that the full weight of my personality is coming to bear. That's super critical.
That's huge. Yeah. So, and on to another topic that I've heard you discuss. I can't remember what it was, I think with other food industry people, and you were talking about social and the importance of influencers, social influencers and stuff. And I've noticed, shockingly, why is it so many, you know, enterprises, big dinosaurs just don't seem to get it? Because, you know, I liken them to these dinosaurs that are just getting old or something like that, where they're still super dangerous, but they're showing glimpses of vulnerability. You know what I mean? And why isn't that happening? Because it seems like low hanging fruit.
Yeah, so this is such a predictable cycle that it amuses me that people still fall victim to it. So it goes like this. You know what you see every day, and the people that are running the company are usually older, right? It's taken them that time to get to that position of power. So usually an executive team are going to be certainly the older people in the company, and maybe just older as a, you know, a general thing. And so the radical changes are always going to come from the youth because they don't have dogma yet. So they're literally searching for what that next thing is. They're completely open to being influenced. They're completely open to new ideas because they are still crafting their vision. Now, over time, they'll find the things that work for them. And sadly, those things will then calcify into dogma. And they then will have their lunch eaten by the next generation. I mean, this is the cycle. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the executives in a company, why do they not use influencers more? Because they're not on social media in their real lives. Mm-hmm. They have no idea who the influencers are. There's no sense of emotional resonance.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I could bring PewDiePie, who's got at last check, and that was like 6 months ago, he had like 40 million followers on YouTube.
Yeah.
Right. So who knows how big it is elsewhere. But if I bring PewDiePie into AT&T, they're not going to know who he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So at that point, that's why it's like they can't get excited. So you'll have a younger team in the company that'll say, hey, this is what you need to do. The older guys go, but that's new. We know what works. We've been doing this for years. It's how we became this big company. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the greatest example of all time is Kodak. Right. Invented the very first digital camera. Like, stop and think about that for a second.
All right.
Kodak invented the digital camera, but they saw their business as being the chemicals in the paper. They didn't realize that we're actually in the memory business, meaning like memories, this barbecue, this day at the beach, this trip to Italy, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, that's the business that you're in. And so whatever is going to help your customer do that better, then you should be getting behind. So they looked at it. They asked the guy, hey, how long is this going to take to get viable? Because obviously the first one was like 1 megapixel. I mean, it's absolutely atrocious. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, how long will it take for this to get viable? He said 15 years. They said, it's not worth it. Forget it. No one's ever going to want to do that. And then, of course, they go out of business. So, I mean, it's just like, it is such a repeatable cycle. If somebody came to me and said, Tom, let me tell you how you're going to be disrupted, and I thought they were out of their minds, I'm so cognizant that that is the cycle that I would listen anyway. And I would do a game, and I would sit there and say, act as if for the next just 10 minutes, act as if they're right. What would that look like? How does that play out? How does it tie into fundamental truths about human psychology? Okay. Once you like, I know that the next generation will disrupt this one. This generation will not disrupt itself. That's just not the way it works. So it will be the next generation. they are more important to advertisers because they're more likely to be swayed. They're more likely to switch a toothpaste. They haven't like just solidified everything. So, okay, we know that they're going to be important from a business perspective because you can move them around the chessboard, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I know that they're going to come with fresh ideas that are then going to impact themselves, who are the most important to people and companies. So it's like you've always got to be watching the youth, not for any esoteric reason. You've got to be watching the youth because they are the disruptors and they're the most valuable to any business. So it's like if you're not, it's just breaking things down to their most fundamental, the nature of selling to humans, like place. And then you can see these patterns that repeat over and over and over.
That's amazing. As a CEO for, or, you know, president of such a big of Quest and everything, I liken it to like flying a 747 with all the dashboards and stuff, everything you have to look at all as it is just for your day-to-day, all the marketing and all the numbers and the HR issues and all the traditional business stuff that you have to deal with and execute on an elite level, top level. And in addition to that, you're considering new stuff. It's just crazy, right? It seems like, I don't know.
Yeah, look, it's just it has to be. So it would be lovely. I mean, absolutely lovely to show up and think everything is going to be the same day after day. Yeah, oh, God, that'd be so nice. Because then, like, you can switch it into that part of your brain that goes on autopilot. And there's actually a whole neuronal network for that, which I'm forgetting the name right now. Mm. But where it is the reason that you can get to work and not remember driving.
Oh, yeah.
Right? You just click over into that. You've done it so many times, like right. Your brain goes into that mode and I think it's called the default network.
Oh, okay.
Where so
like
you
a Pavlovian type of thing almost.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's like it's total autopilot.
Right.
So it's lovely. It takes less cognitive load, but it doesn't lead anywhere good.
So I want to know also, how do you identify a great idea? So I like to call myself the reverse venture capitalist in that, like, if you give me a great idea, I'm going to think it's going to be horrible. So I got a couple really big examples, right? So I talked to Phil Libin when he was starting Evernote, right? And he pitched to me and I was like, this sounds terrible. Your brain in the cloud, you could just FTP stuff to a server. Why would anyone not want to do that? Evernote's a joke. And then I remember talking to Ryan Graves way back in the day, you know, he's one of the founders of Uber. And he told me, you know, we were talking about his early Uber idea. This was one of my huge misses, obviously, right? And I'm like, what? You're going to try to partner with other limo drivers at various airports? From a scalability perspective, to me, it sounded like a freaking nightmare, right? So I'm like, this is a terrible idea, right? So I'm obviously the king of, you know, if you want to lose or make lots of money, you know, don't go with me. So how do you identify these great ideas? I remember you thinking about Uber in one of these interviews and you're saying, I immediately knew it was a great idea, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, and I say that from the perspective of, hey, once it's been done and I'm looking at it, then I can get it. This is not okay. Me saying like, I don't know how I would have reacted if they had pitched it. And I think we all have stories where we look at something that becomes so self-evident that right. In the beginning just does not make sense.
Right.
The one idea that I'll say I actually had like a really minor part of, and it's such a good reminder to me that when you have that idea, rather than say, oh, that would never work, like really explore it. And that was Waze. So I remember sitting in traffic, I'm stuck in traffic and I'm like, you know, what's weird? Like your phone has a motion sensor, so it should be able to detect how fast I'm moving. So my thing was, I wanted to know accurately how long will it take me to get somewhere.
Yeah.
And or to like avoid like really bad traffic, right? Yeah. So you'd be driving along just fine and then you'd stop and be like, oh man, I would have taken that last exit if I'd known there was an accident or whatever. And I thought, but no one would ever send that data to the cloud. Like people are so weird about their privacy.
Yeah.
So I was like, yeah, no one would ever do that. And then like 8 months later, Waze comes out and I was like, damn it.
Yeah. That's awesome. I love to hear about these misses, you know?
Yeah, so I just remind myself that, and look, Waze is way better than what I was thinking about at the time. So this is not me saying like they stole my idea. Very much not the case.
Yeah.
But it was one of those that like I had thought, oh, that would be so cool, but no one will ever do it. And then of course somebody was already hard at work on it. So you really do have to push yourself. So I mean, how do I recognize good ideas? You don't always. A lot of times you're going to miss. So for me, it's always been betting on myself. It's been one of those things that I really, really believe in and I'm willing to fight for and push for because building something is hard. So I don't know that I would make a great venture guy. I think I'm really good at helping people that are building businesses because I've done it before.
Right.
And I definitely can see how things can scale And scalability has really become like, I've just trained my mind to work like that.
Yeah.
So I've been working with some people on marketing, which obviously is my forte, and then scalability. Like, how do you really do this at scale? And do you have to sort of back up and reconceive of what the sort of fundamental offering is, or at least the approach to the offering? Because I find a lot of people come to something that's a great sort of one-on-one idea, but it doesn't scale. And so you get these guys that, like, they're essentially, their business model will be something like a guy who owns a restaurant and really secretly just wants to, like, be known in that restaurant, have people love the food, shake their hand, ask them to sit at the table. Like, that's what, when they describe their business, no matter what it is, it sounds like that. It's the guy that wants to be high touch with a few people.
Yeah.
And it's, but they'll tell you, and I want to be rich. So it's like, okay, cool. But you need to choose, because if you're going to be that high touch guy one-on-one in the restaurant, you're never going to get rich. You're going to get rich by coming up with a chain that can be franchised, that does something new, something different, that really comes in and disrupts, solves a pain point, so that you know that people are actually going to go for it. And most, 99.999% of the people that come to your restaurant will never see you. They will not know who you are. And so you need to decide, because one path will lead to wealth and the other may lead to more fulfillment. So you just have to decide, like, what do you actually want?
Yeah. And I got to admit, you know, when I first saw you, I was like, okay, who, you know, who's this guy? He's got a, like, a ton of money. You know, what, why is he, is this like a, just doing this, you know, for some sort of ego thing or something like that? And then I remember watching one of the interviews where you admitted, and it sort of touches on pride, right? Is you admitted to Tim Ferriss, who I've met before too, is that you were painting your set at like 3 a.m. with your wife, Lisa, right? And you didn't even flinch admitting it, right? And it's, so have you always not, like, just given a fuck, or is it, you know, cause not giving a fuck is a huge advantage in life, you know, cause there are a lot of people, myself included, where I've worried about what other people think, right? And it totally hinders you.
Yeah. My thing, like, don't be confused. I care what other people think for sure. But my thing is, I'm goal oriented. So I don't care as much about what other people think as I care about achieving my goal. So, man, the one thing I would tell people to really focus on is get really clear about what you want. Because if you don't know what you want, you will drift forever. And I think people, I mean, really, because the problem 100%. Is, all we have is this moment right here. And this moment usually isn't that painful. It's only when you take this moment and really bundle it and look at it like, holy hell, for the last 8 years, I've built somebody else's company for them. I feel that I've been taken advantage of. I've been neglected. People don't listen to my ideas. Any one day of that isn't that big of a deal. And that's how you get into this weekend cycle, right? It's like, if I just need to survive this week. This weekend is going to be awesome. And the thing is, the weekend is awesome. And so people, they go out on a Saturday or maybe a Friday and they get drunk and it's awesome. It's messing with your brain chemistry. You really do have a great time. You go dance, you party, you hang out with friends. It's fucking rad. And so then you're like, okay, I'll just survive that next week and then I'll do the weekend again. And so they get in this cycle of, the week isn't, it's painful, but it's not painful enough to start sacrificing their weekends to make sure they get the hell out of this rut. So that's where most people exist, is like in pain, but it's like that sort of dull, like, marathon pain. It's not that acute sprinting, gasping for breath, I'm afraid I'm going to die pain. Like, when you get into that moment, suddenly it's like, okay, I need to make a change.
Right.
So my thing is, you have to have an exciting vision of what you want that you can run towards. Because once you have that, then things really start to get interesting, because you've got a compelling future that you're willing to work for. You're willing to sacrifice momentary pleasures to get that thing. But it all starts with knowing what that thing is. If you don't know what that thing is, you're screwed. And so for me, it's like, I'm just working backwards from that. Like, what do I need to do? Oh, should I care what somebody thinks? Oh no, that won't help me. Okay. Well then I'm embarrassed, but fuck it. I've got to just keep going. I'm going to do my thing. I'm going to ignore them, because ignoring them is what gets me to where I want to go. Oh, I need to listen to what they think. Okay, cool. Well, I'm going to stand here and just take it and really figure out, what do I need to do? What do I need to change in order to reach my goal? But it's always about the goal.
That's well. So can you talk about this 9-hour Instagram post?
Yeah. So I, by nature, I'm a perfectionist, and I really, really want to bring value to people's lives. And so I Not being, so I didn't grow up with social media. So this is very much something that got bolted onto my life much later. And so I was coming at it the way that I like to read things. And I like things to be really powerful, really punchy, well-constructed sentences, just like it works on a lot of levels. And so I would write these like epic Instagram posts being really pissed that they limited the number of characters, by the way. Like I thought I should be able to write as much as I want. But they would stop it. So then I'd really have to work sometimes just to make it shorter. Like if they had just let me make it longer, it would have been much faster. And so I would spend, you know, usually 3 hours probably on an Instagram post.
Wow.
And then finally one time it took me 9 hours and I thought,
that's amazing.
And I started reading the comments and people were like, "Hey man, really read like the caption on this one. It's fantastic."
Yeah.
And I thought, hold on a second. People have to tell somebody to read the caption. That's like not a by default thing. So I'm working this hard for something where like occasionally someone will say, "Hey, you should really read this."
Yeah, scalability, right?
This is a bad strategy. So I, you know, going back to my goals, what are my goals? I need to be posting more frequently. I'm trying to build an audience. I'm trying to add value. This isn't scalable, which is my whole thing. So how good can I make it in 20 minutes? So can I get 80% of the way to there? Can I get 90% of the way? Like how close can I get? And I would say I probably get 90% of the way to the impact. They're not as well written. There's no question about that. But in terms of impact, I get 90% of the way there. I do it in 20 minutes. That's much more scalable anyway.
Right.
And so I just had to make that shift because it was absurd.
You must like to suffer though. Cause I watch you also when you craft these intros for these guests. I saw you talk about, I believe it was a neuroscientist where you crafted an intro for him that you had on, and it took you a lot of time and you went over and over it again. And I'm like, this guy's a freaking crazy hard worker, man.
Nuts. Yeah, it goes back to goals, man. So it's like the intros are really, really important. So if you have a guest coming on and you want to get them out of what I call their loop. So when they go on a show, first of all, just assume they've been on 100 other shows and 98% of the people have asked them the exact same questions.
Yep.
And so they've gotten really good at their loop. And so they'll slip into that loop. Like you've got to work to get them out of that loop.
Yeah.
And what I realized was, okay, if I'm, you know, this is back when I started Inside Quest. If I'm going to be good at this, I need to deliver an interview that nobody else is delivering. So the only way for me to do that is to go in, see what are all the things that they always say. Because first of all, the things that people repeat are the things that they think make them look cool. They think that are like amazing, that add value, all this stuff, right? So there's a reason that they say those things. Right. So I like to acknowledge those things in the interview so that they feel heard, that all that stuff that they're like, I really want the audience to know this about me. I just say it for them, right? Which is way more powerful than them having to say it themselves. And then it does one ultimate thing, which is really critical. It robs them of those stories because now they'll sound like they're repeating me. So I wanted to acknowledge them, honor them, and steal all of their ideas right up front. So now we have to go somewhere new so that when I ask you a new question, you can't wrangle it back to one of your talking points because I already said it in the intro. Right. And that it has worked amazingly well.
You clever, clever bird.
Right. So, and the key is to be able to write that, I have to actually come to understand them. And so that's it's been great. I think without the pressure of the intro, I might not do as much research. That's the honest answer. So I'm able to get, I think, a great interview because of all the work that I have to put into researching them to make sure that I know them well enough to write that intro, to honor them, to really get them to lower their guard, to know that I truly am coming from a place of authentic interest and fascination with who they are and what they bring to the table, and then make sure that we're going somewhere new.
What is thinkitating?
So when you meditate, you get into what's called an alpha wave state. So it's calm and alert. It's known as one of the most creative brain states. And I found it really frustrating to meditate because I would get there. And so the ideas that I was telling myself not to think about, right? Because when you're meditating, you're supposed to calm your mind. I'd find myself thinking about these really great ideas. And I'm like, holy hell. And so I was like, okay, there's something wrong here because the ideas that pop up when I'm meditating are like the best ideas I'm going to have all day.
Yeah.
So I just needed an outlet for that. So I said, okay, look, I'll meditate for like 15, 20 minutes. Then I want to take the buzz, essentially, because it feels really good. Mm-hmm. I want to take the buzz of that meditative state and apply it to my biggest problem in business. So before I sit down to meditate, I've picked a problem that I want my mind to noodle on. I meditate and truly try to clear my mind. I try not to think about that or anything else. And then when I'm in that state, then I change my posture. I usually lay back. I keep a computer next to me. And I just let my mind wander on that problem. Sometimes it stays on that problem and comes up with amazing solutions. Sometimes it wanders to something else and comes up with something amazing. And other times it's like a fucking flat line and I get absolutely nothing. But the amount of times that I get like a really just a key insight is it makes all the other times worth it.
I'm curious what, you know, you seem like such an intense dude all the time. What makes you laugh? Like, what's the last thing that made you laugh to the point of like where you were like freaking crying when you were embarrassed to be, you know, it happening or something like that?
I don't remember the last time I did it, but I'll tell you the one that was most transformational for me. Have you ever heard of a comedian named Mitch Hedberg?
Yes. The one line king.
All right.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Yes. So Mitch Hedberg, I saw him live. I had no idea who he was. And in the middle of his set, I actually asked myself, can you laugh until you die? Because I could not catch my breath. It was so, tears were streaming down my face. I mean, it was absurd. I was on the fucking floor. It was by far the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. And recently, I'm sure it'd be something that my wife says every now and then. She'll hit me with a zinger that just has me in fits.
That kind of like when you're Hedberg sweating, like, you know, you're laughing so hard and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I love that. I love that.
That's great. So what does be legendary mean to you? What are you trying to ask or say when you say that?
Well, here's the really bad news. So that started as like I was doing my first interview. I got to the end, was doing an outro. I'd never done an outro before. Right. I don't pre-write my outros. So for as much time as I put into the intro, the outros are totally improvised.
Yeah.
And I got to the end of the outro and I was like, oh, fuck, what do I say? And I was like, be legendary, my friends. I was like, what was that?
Okay, and so gotcha.
Literally, I thought, all right, I need to come up with something better for the next one. Get to the second interview. I spent so much time doing the intro again. I totally forget that I'm going to have to do an outro. The outro comes. It comes out of my mouth again. And then I'm like, oh, dear Lord. And then it just stuck and it became like a thing. But if you're going to go back and apply some real meaning to it, at the end of the day, that's what I'm trying to do, which is why I'm sure it was the thing that popped into my mind because I am trying to echo through history, right? Like I'm not going to be bashful about that. That's the scale at which I want to play. I want to turn myself into a legend. And so to do that, you've just got to A, be willing to believe that you're worthy of that. B, accept that you don't yet have the skill set to pull that off and that you're going to have to work your ass off to get to that point. All of those things, like, I love that. I love having the arrogance of belief, but the belief is that I can do it, not that I already am it. And then three, for me, that pursuit, man, that is the juice for me. The pursuit is what I care about because it's the pursuit that makes me feel most alive.
Yeah. Well, I want to be respectful of your time. So just a couple more if we can.
Sure.
So I've noticed like what seems to be, in my perspective, one of your superpowers, and you bring it up often, is you seem to have an ability to hook into your audience psyche and articulate these shared experiences that many of us can relate to, right? So one example you use, and you mentioned earlier, is The Matrix, right? And it's one of those things where you can feel that something is wrong, right, in the world, in your life, at work, whatever it may be, but you just seem to go through it, right? And but other people don't. They take a very different path. Can you expand on this?
Yeah, so, you know, to me, it really does come down to if you know what you're trying to accomplish and you're prepared to put the work in to pull that off, then if you believe that you can do anything you set your mind to, how you spend your time becomes a spiritual consideration. So I have a compelling future. There's something that I'm working towards. I have a belief that I can actually become that person. And because of that belief, I know that, all right, once I've identified what I want, I simply have to work backwards and figure out what is the gap in skill set and then go out and get it. And why do most people not do that? I think it comes down to a couple things. One, they don't actually believe that they can do it. So they have a fixed mindset. They believe that their talent and intelligence are fixed. They were born with it. It just is what it is. Mm-hmm. And because I think people confuse like, hey, there are certain things in my life that I get early wins. So those are my genetic gifts. And then there's things that are really hard for me. And therefore, I'm just not good at that. And if they would just add the word yet, like I'm just not good at that yet. Like, so I'll give you an example. I'm really bad at genetically, I have a very hard time losing fat. Okay, I have what they call thrifty genes. So whether it's an epigenetic result of how my mother was eating when I was in utero, I have no idea. It's probably genes and epigenetics combined. So for me to put on fat is very, very easy. Now, from an evolutionary perspective, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It means that I'm going to survive a famine, right? So I need very little calories to have an abundance of what I need, which then is stored as adipose tissue. But aesthetically, that's not great, and it's really not great when you can get a bag of chips or ice cream around the corner every day, and that stuff tastes good. It's amazing, so it's a bit of a bummer. But that doesn't mean I can't get lean. It just means maybe much harder for me than somebody else. But once you remove the, like, I'm not going to waste time worrying about whether it's fair. I'm just going to accept that it is, and I'm going to act accordingly. So if getting lean is important enough to me, I will overcome those obstacles. I will not spend time whining about it. So all of those like mental constructs are why I push through and do the things that are important to me. And to me, it's just, I understand the fundamental nature of the human condition.
That's it. Yeah. Very good. So can you tell us why your mom thought you were going to be a failure, that whole story? Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, my mom has always been my biggest cheerleader. I didn't know this. So it came about because one day, probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, she was still trying to get me to move back home. And I'm like, okay, wait, I have to ask. She essentially kicked me out of the nest when I was 18. I had a moment of panic. I didn't want to leave. No one else from my high school was leaving. They were basically all going to the same school. And I saw this out. Something was going to be a little bit hard in the process of me going to college. And I said, you know what? It's probably not worth it. I should just stay here. And my mom flipped her shit and was like, there's no way you're going to go. It's your dream. You're going to chase your dreams. You're never going to say what if. Like, you need to go. Mm-hmm. And so she really just pushed me to do it. And then literally every day since I left, she has been asking me to come back home. So finally, I just said, why did you push me so hard to leave and then turn around to be the person trying to get me back? And she just, and she said with like no malice in her heart, she just goes, I always assumed you would fail.
Didn't even skip a beat.
Wow. Not at all. I was like, wow, that is amazing. And I thanked her. I said, that's such a gift to know that even you couldn't see the potential, right?
Wow,
but I didn't show any early signs of being successful. My own mother, who knew me better, loved me better, wanted more things for me, pushed me. Like, even she just thought, man, this poor fucking kid is just never going to make it. So that really helped me understand like my journey, because I've always felt that there was people looked at me and saw one thing and they didn't see the thing to me, which has always been obvious, that I would be successful, right? Which for me was I was going to be rich and have six pack abs. Like nobody else could see that, but like I knew it was going to be true. And I knew it was going to be true because I would just find a way, somehow, some way, I would find a way to make that happen. And so in that way, my life has become a self-fulfilling prophecy because I've just always known what I wanted. And so all the big breakthroughs in my life have been identifying those moments where I acted out of alignment with my stated goal. And so the big breakthrough for me was realizing, okay, well, either admit you don't want that goal, which, hey, fine, but don't live in this weird world where you say that you want it, but then you don't do anything about it. So either change the thing you say you want so you can find something that's exciting that you're totally in aligned with from just an action standpoint. Like, there was a moment where I had to say, do you want to be sort of monk-like so that you can chill, read, and play video games? Or do you actually want to get rich and have six pack abs and be a legend and echo through time? And like, which one of those paths is real? Because neither one is more intrinsically valuable, right? So wanting, like, I could do a whole dissertation on why only fools focus on becoming a legend and echoing through history and like the, you know, to spend your life doing that and to miss so many present moments for that. Like, it just doesn't make sense, right? And I can give you a dissertation on why being a monk doesn't make any sense. So it's like, it really, there's no objective truth. It comes down to what makes you feel most alive. And the truth is, I've studied Buddhism enough to know that removing myself from the wants and desires of a human just doesn't resonate with me. I get it. I know why some people choose that path and I'm super happy for them, but that's not what I want for myself. And I know that the pursuit of wringing every drop of potential out of my being over here on this other side, whether I become a legend or not, it's irrelevant to me. Did I wring as much potential out of myself as I possibly could at every second? Because I love that feeling, right? I love that feeling now, today, in this moment. I don't need some distant thing to happen.
That's infectious, for sure. Can you, last question here, and it's killing me because I don't see it right now, and I always see it on you. Can you talk about the significance of the necklace?
I actually don't have one on. That's funny. I always have a necklace on. I assure you later today, I will have a necklace on. So honestly, we live in a world right now where I can't get enough necklaces that mean something to me, that they all are important. But it's two parts. One, I actually am really into fashion. I love fashion. And so I started getting necklaces just because I thought they looked cool. And then started finding necklaces like my beloved Star Wars necklace.
Is that what it is? Okay, it looks like a dog tag kind of thing.
Well, the one you're thinking of probably is a dog tag, but I have another one that's a Star Wars medallion.
Cool.
And so part of it is I'm also planting seeds. So we're a merchandising company, really, at the end of the day. And so I want people to see how to use that ideology. And I'm just hyper aware to know that the initial wave will be people doing things to emulate what I'm doing to show an affinity for impact theory. So I do what's called high-low fashion because it gives a chance for people to express themselves. Like I'm wearing a Matrix reference t-shirt right now. It's the white rabbit and just says follow. So, you know, stuff like that. And I do it because I love it. I love being reminded of the Matrix. I love being reminded of the ideology and the mythology and all of that that surrounds it. And it helps me remember my own identity and push through hard times. But it also signals to the community that this is part of the movement, right? Like expressing yourself through a t-shirt is part of the movement of impact theory. And so that's why we'll be selling t-shirts and crowdsourcing the designs and all that stuff. And so by being the example now, I know that the first wave, and it'll only be the first wave, and then it'll morph and change after that. But the first wave will be that. The first wave will be the patterns that I set, and then people will jump in, they'll do that, then the crowd will take over, and then I'll find myself emulating the crowd. And so it's, you know, that I forget who said this quote, but humans make tools, and then humans shape tools, and then the tools shape them back. And so it's like I will shape the crowd in the beginning and then the crowd will shape me back and then it will become sort of indistinguishable and I'm racing towards that moment.
Beautiful, man. Well, thank you so much. Where can we get more information on you and what's happening with everything Quest, Impact Theory and everything?
Yeah, so hit me up socially. I'm super active socially. You can find me at Tom Bilyeu and my last name is spelled B as in Bravo, I-L-Y-E-U. And so yeah, come on out. You can find me Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, all of it.
All the places. All right, everyone. Thanks so much for your time. Thanks for watching, listening again. I am Adolfo Fronda at NerdStalker on Twitter. Remember, go to NerdStalker.com. Check us at all the places. Thumbs up, subscribe. You know the routine. Appreciate your time.
See you. Thanks for having me on, man. It was awesome.
You bet.